Hello, I'm Adrian Finnegan. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, Russia shuts off Europe's main gas pipeline after the G7 countries agreed to cap the prices of Russian oil. And the EU plans to set a limit on Moscow's gas prices. Who's winning the energy battle? Also this week, Europe's energy crisis deepens as Russia tightens its chokehold on supplies. The EU says it's prepared to meet the challenge should Moscow turn off the gas taps. But is it? And skyrocketing energy prices are squeezing people's incomes in rich and poor countries alike. When will global inflation peak? Or could the rising cost of living remain far too hot? An all-out energy war between Russia and the West threatens to deepen Europe's energy crisis, putting pressure on governments to make interventions in the energy market to rein in soaring prices. But it also puts the Kremlin's revenues at risk and is meant to stem the flow of funds into its war coffers. Moscow's earnings from energy exports are expected to rise by 38% this year. Western capitals say they want to cut off that financial lifeline. The G7 group, the US, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy and the UK have agreed to cap the price of Russian oil. Shortly after that decision, Russia's energy giant announced an indefinite halt to gas flows to Europe through the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline, citing the need for additional repairs. Gas prices surged more than 35%. The euro slid to its lowest in two decades as Moscow warned that it won't reopen that pipeline until sanctions are lifted. And the EU is planning a cap on Russian gas prices too, among other proposals to curb soaring energy costs. President Vladimir Putin has warned the West that it cannot isolate Russia. He says that Western sanctions against Moscow have backfired and now threaten the whole world. Al Jazeera's Nadeem Barber reports.
A bold move from Brussels, but will it work? The European Commission's going ahead with a plan for a new price cap on Russian natural gas.
We all know that our sanctions are deeply grinding into the Russian economy with a heavy negative impact. But Putin is partially buffering through fossil fuel revenues. So here the objective is we must cut Russia's revenues, which Putin uses to finance his atrocious war in Ukraine.
Since February, the EU's imposed sanctions on Russia and acted to wean itself off Russian energy. Some member states are sceptical of the price cap, worried it could push Moscow to turn off the taps completely. Russia's already stopped or reduced supplies on three of its biggest westward gas pipelines, while oil supplies have been redirected eastwards.
Its economy, of course, is now more cut off from the West and from many global markets than at any point since the end of the Cold War. And in some respects, the way that the war in Ukraine has gone and Russia's subjection to sanctions means that Russia's economic fate is sealed. It has to become an Asia-facing, Eastern-facing economic power, or it will economically perish.
If President Putin's worried, he's not letting on. Speaking at the Eastern Economic Forum in Vladivostok, he called the price cap idea stupid. He also addressed another issue with global implications, Ukraine's grain exports. Shipments like this one resumed after Kyiv and Moscow reached a deal in July, with Turkey and the United Nations acting as guarantors. But Putin says the developing world is being cheated.
If we remove Turkey as an intermediary, virtually all the grain was brought not to the poorest countries, but to the European Union. The World Food Programme speaks of the need for the poorest countries. Out of 60,000 tons of production, just 3% went to developing countries.
UN data shows Turkey has been the biggest single destination, with cargoes also going to China, India, Egypt, Yemen, Somalia and Djibouti. Whatever the reality, Vladimir Putin insists his country's already seen off the worst effects of Western sanctions, saying inflation has started to fall. He told this gathering Russia's natural resources would protect the nation as jobs and companies disappeared in Europe. That's surely a warning the continent can't ignore.
Joining us now, David Beck, the chief economist at London-based energy intelligence provider Vortexa. He's in Quito in Ecuador. Good to have you with us, David. So the EU is planning this cap on gas prices, among other proposals. Is that going to help its energy market? So it's just simply raise the stakes even further with Russia?
Yes, the stakes with Russia are already extremely high. I would say the gas price cap question is secondary to the oil price cap question, because the latter one is of global importance. The former one is primarily a question for the European market at this point of time. There are also two aspects to this gas price cap. The one is simply the price that is paid to Russia for gas imports. But ultimately, the more important question at this point of time is whether this classical merit order in power generation is put out of force. The merit order means that always the most expensive power source will define the price of electricity. And this is now natural gas, with a very small share in the overall power mix, basically leading to massive windfall profits for the power generation industry that is processing renewables or coal or nuclear or whatever.
Okay.
So these are the two considerations of the European Union.
We'll talk about that, how the energy market is priced, a little later in the program. In the meantime, you mentioned the cap on oil there. Is that cap on oil prices going to work? And why does the West need that price cap when European nations are trying to phase out their reliance upon Russian oil in the first place?
The oil price cap is basically not needed that much from the European point of view. It's needed from the global point of view, because the question is, how much oil does supply Russia to the market? And there is an insurance ban coming up on shipping oil to third countries, and that is a powerful ban from the European Union. And that is threatening basically to cut off Russian supply. Russia is actually struggling to place its barrels in the market. Yes, China and India are buying more than they used to, but pretty much everybody else has stayed on the sidelines due to the complexities. And that is, as now, there is even no actually legal restriction in importing Russian oil. But the insurance ban will come up in December, or will be fully effective in December this year. And that is something that you could say is actually forcing G7 and the European Union in installing this price cap, because as part of this price cap, this insurance ban would be stopped or ended.
As you said, China and India could undermine the price cap anyway by continuing to buy Russian oil at whatever price Russia charges. How do you go about then policing this G7 price cap on oil?
Yeah, let me say first a word on China and India. I think it's also in their interest. I just looked up our data, and China and India have imported 9% of their oil from Russia before the war started, and now they're importing 17% of their oil from Russia. So that means still 83% of their oil is imported from other countries. So it's essential for those countries as well that the oil price remains as low as possible, and the global oil price cap would basically also incentivize Russia to export as much as oil as possible, because that would then be the only lever for income, to raise production and exports. So this is why it's in their interest. And ultimately, every buyer wants to buy as cheap as possible. And if there is a fixed price set, in my opinion, that would have to be on a FOB basis, so on a Russia export basis. And then there are still all the logistical costs to be paid for China and India and any other place in the world. There is simply a very clear incentive for any consumer country. If this reference price is there, then they will try to get as close to it. Whether they may perhaps pay a $1 or $2 or a $5 premium in some illicit ways, individual players, that's not really of relevance. The important thing is whether it's 50 or whether it's 100.
In a speech on Wednesday, President Putin threatened to cut off energy supplies completely to Europe. What happens if he does?
Yes, the question is, can he? Short-term answer, yes, of course, he can do this for a week, for a day. He can threaten with it. Can he do it in the long term? I'm speaking here of months, 1 month, 2 months, 3 months. I would say no. I think it's important to understand the contributions of gas and oil to the Russian budget. The oil contribution is about 4 times bigger than the gas contribution. So that's why they could play the gas card with Europe. But they can, in my opinion, not play the oil card on a persistent basis. That they can make troubles in the short term, that's very clear.
David, it's really good to talk to you on Counting the Cost. Many thanks indeed. David Vec there in Quito in Ecuador. Now, Europe has accused Russia of using energy as a weapon against those supporting Ukraine. The Kremlin blames Western sanctions for pipeline shutdowns. Moscow has already stopped sending gas to what it calls unfriendly European nations because they refuse to pay in rubles. Europe's leaders are now bracing for the risk of a Russian gas cutoff and are scrambling to find ways to cut demand. They've rapidly filled their gas storage facilities, and countries' stores have exceeded the 80% target that was set to be reached by October. Some European nations, like Germany, have also sought alternative supplies, like liquefied natural gas from the US and Qatar. But that's still a work in progress. Norway, Europe's second biggest gas supplier behind Russia, is raising production to help the EU end its reliance on Russian fossil fuels by 2027. Algeria is also among the countries looking to increase supplies to European nations like Italy and Spain. European nations are voluntarily reducing their gas consumption by 15% in an attempt to get through winter, and they're reactivating coal or nuclear plants to fill the energy gap, while others are turning to electricity imports, renewables and hydropower. Well, to discuss all of this, we're joined by Simone Tagliapietra. Simone is a senior fellow at the Bruegel think tank and a researcher on the EU's energy and climate policies. He joins us now from Brussels. Simone, good to have you with us. Now, to what extent is the rising cost of energy down not just to the war in Ukraine, but the crazy way in which the energy markets operate, the marginal pricing system for electricity, in which, as we heard earlier in the programme, the highest price bid sets the overall price, and speculators driving up the price of gas on the TTF? Is it fair to say that this is as much a crisis of badly designed and obsolete institutions that enrich a tiny few at the expense of everyone else than it is about the war?
Well, as a matter of fact, the European electricity market design that you described has functioned very well for a long period of time. But this is a situation we are in, which is a war, and it is a weaponization of energy that has been done by Russia, which makes the current market setting unfit for the emergency we are in. So this is a market that functions pretty well in peacetime, but we are not in peacetime right now. And this is the reason why the European Commission is proposing not to overturn this market design in a rush, because this is a complex set of rules that is also very important to provide investment certainty and foster investments in renewables, namely in the coming years, but adopting emergency measures that might take out part of those extra profits that have been done by the generators of electricity with renewables, nuclear, etc., in order to use those resources for lowering the energy bills of energy companies, of companies, families across Europe. So this is the kind of emergency measures the Commission proposes to do without disrupting this electricity market design right now, because it will take time to rethink that, and that will be done most likely next year.
Europe's LNG imports have increased. How long, though, can it rely on shipments? I mean, some countries don't have the infrastructure even to take on board LNG that's shipped to Europe. And who are the winners benefiting from this current energy crisis, other than those, as you said, who are earning huge profits right now?
It is crystal clear that the real extra profits now stand in the producing countries. So whoever is producing gas and exporting it to Europe, either via pipeline or via LNG, is now making a lot of money. And this is why we start to see also conversations. For example, we have recently seen an interview by the Norwegian Prime Minister saying we are aware of the difficult situation, right, of Europe and the very high gas price. We are open to discuss price caps in order to lower our own gas supplies to Europe, the price of our own gas supplies to Europe, if we revise our long-term contracts in such a manner. So I think there is a clear recognition that some countries, the gas producers, the oil producers, are making a lot of money in this moment, and this certainly represents an international, let's say, distributional issue.
Russia also, of course, facing a long, cold winter. Just how much have Western sanctions against Russia hurt its economy? President Putin says that the sanctions have backfired. Is he right, or are the people of Russia going to feel it hard this winter too?
Well, the very reason that Moscow has been rushing in closing Nord Stream in September, rather than, as many expected, in the winter, might be a sign that Russia wants to anticipate and escalates before the pressure it can try to escalate towards Europe, because probably sanctions are biting. And we know very well that sanctions that have been put on Russia will seriously compromise the Russian economy in the medium long term. We know that without exporting its energy to Europe, Russia will end up being a minor partner in a relationship with China, which will not certainly be so convenient for the Russian people. And I think we are very aware of this timing dimension. It's true, in the short term, it's Europe that will suffer and is suffering because of the high energy prices. But Europe is proving its capability of rebalancing away from Russian gas. And once this is done in a structural manner, it will be Russia bearing the longer-term cost of the war he decided to start against Ukraine.
Really good to talk to you, Simon. Many thanks indeed for being with us once again. Thanks. Simon Tagliapietra there in Brussels. The cost of living has been rising ever since pandemic lockdowns disrupted global supply chains and caused panic buying in the supermarkets. Now Russia's invasion of Ukraine is pushing the price of almost everything, from energy to wheat, further up. Inflation is near double-digit territory in many of the world's biggest economies, a level not seen in close to half a century. In Indonesia, for example, the price of petrol and diesel went up about 30% last week after the government cut subsidies. Al Jazeera's Jessica Washington reports from Jakarta.
From 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., Sarwoko rides through the streets of the Indonesian capital. He became a motorbike taxi driver after losing his job at an exhibition centre during the pandemic. He is one of millions of people battling to make ends meet after the government cut fuel subsidies.
The money I make is already not enough. Often, I don't eat lunch just so I can spend the money on my children's need.
Fuel prices went up by about 30%, with subsidized petrol increasing from around 51 cents to 67 cents per litre, and diesel going up from 35 to 46 cents per litre. Soaring global oil and gas prices, as well as the depreciation of the local currency, tripled the state's subsidy budget to $34 billion. The government says it's reallocating some funds to social grants, with 20 million low-income households set to receive around $10 a month until the end of the year. For many, it's an inadequate solution.
The cash aid is like candy, totally useless. We want them to lower the price of fuel.
Unions and students have led protests in several cities.
Around the country, the message is clear. Many people are worried about stagnant wages and the rising cost of living, and those concerns have been exacerbated by this latest policy change.
Some economists are also critical of the decision.
All of the society, all of the consumers' level hit by the increase of the fuel price. And at the same time, the minimum wage in Indonesia is only increased by 1%. So inflation versus the income of the ordinary citizen in Indonesia is not catch up.
Higher fuel costs have a knock-on effect. Essential goods become more expensive because logistics expenses increase. A worrying prospect for Ardi, who is already skipping meals.
Before the price hike, life was already hard. Now it's even more difficult.
He spends an extra dollar and a half on fuel every day. It's an expense that he, like millions of Indonesians, cannot afford.
Joining us now from London is Paul Donovan, who is chief economist at UBS Bank Global Wealth Management. Paul, good to have you with us on Counting the Cost once again. We've been talking a lot on the program today about Europe's energy crisis. Are people really going to have to choose between staying warm and eating? Is the $375 billion relief package that's been proposed going to be enough?
I think the package is going to go a long way to mitigating the costs to individuals and perhaps a little bit less as far as cost to businesses are concerned, but there is some assistance there. Of course, you know, this is not a precise science. It depends how cold the winter is. It depends on how much people are able to cut back on energy consumption. And of course, the bigger the shock in terms of limiting gas supplies, limiting power generation, the bigger the reaction that you get. Your people will turn down thermostats, they will work from home, which is a big energy saving, drive less frequently, another big energy saving. So it's a very, very imprecise calculation, I'm afraid.
Of course, inflation biting everywhere, but it hits hardest in the developing world. What has been the impact of inflation there? President Putin says that Ukrainian grain exports that were done under the deal that President Erdogan brokered are helping richer nations at the expense of the developing world. Is he right?
No, I think that's an overly simplistic analysis, to put it politely. What we've got to remember, of course, is that agricultural commodities don't have a huge impact directly on inflation in developed countries, because food in developed countries isn't really food. Food in a developed country is nearly all labor costs. And the agricultural commodities, the price the farmer gets, is a very small part. The issue here is that when we see rising agricultural commodity prices, that is something which hits less developed economies a lot more significantly, because in a less developed economy, food is effectively a lot closer to the farmer. It's also worth bearing in mind, we were going to have a food price problem this year because it's a La Nina weather system this year. And climate change has been making the La Nina effect more and more destructive over time. So, you know, the effects of the droughts in the west coast of the United States, the disruption to the monsoon season in India and Pakistan, you know, those are things which were going to happen anyway, have had a significant impact on agricultural commodity prices. War in Ukraine has made things worse, but this was going to be a high food price year anyway.
Okay, let's take in China, let's take in the US here, and interest rates. A broad brush question here for you, Paul. Are we likely to see a global recession? I know certain economies in certain parts of the world are predicting recessions. Others aren't, though.
I think a global slowdown will happen. That is to say, we would expecting growth to slow this year anyway, because the frantic pace of consumption we had after the global pandemic was starting to fade. With the United States slowing down, as it is doing, and with Europe slowing down, I mean, there you've got the largest and the second largest economy in the world. So, of course, you're going to get a global slowdown. I think a recession, which, you know, there's no proper definition of what a recession is, but a recession defined as a period of significantly below trend growth, that's clearly a risk. But I think it is very much a risk case. And the signals that we're seeing from the United States, for example, are still showing us that the consumer is prepared to support the economy and prevent us going into some kind of economic slump. China's economy is weak, but China's economy is quite insular. So, you know, what happens in China doesn't necessarily have a huge global impact. The European economy is where we've got the most uncertainty, of course. Okay. But overall, I think it's slowed down rather than slump.
And a very brief answer I need from you here, Paul, because we're almost out of time. How long before inflation begins to ease?
It's already easing in the United States. In Europe, it depends on the precise nature of government policies, but fairly soon.
Always good to talk to you, Paul. Many thanks indeed. Paul Donovan there at UBS Global Wealth Management. And that's our show for this week. Don't forget, if you want to comment on anything that you've seen, you can get in touch with us. I'm at A Finnegan on Twitter. Use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, please, or drop us a line. countingthecostataljazeera.net is our email address. There's plenty more for you online, as always, at aljazeera.com/CTC. That takes you straight to our page, and there you'll find individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. But that is it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Adrian Finnegan from the whole team. Thanks for being with us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.